Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 16th of Kislev. Now, if you're listening to this response of the day, you probably have been listening a bunch of times before, because this is being taped fairly late in the process. The process was, I did 5 days a week for a year, and then I'm now filling out, rounding out the year, so that by the time you get the 16th of Kislev the second time around, there's an audio shear taped for it. So it's fairly late in the game. On the other hand, the 16th of Kislev is the yard site of Avraham Yitzchak Holland, my father-in-law, who passed away a few years ago, and I actually spoke about this shear, about this responsum, 2-3 years ago on his yard site, probably 2 years ago. So this is a responsum I've had around for a while as part of this project, but I'm only just taping it now. And even so, I'm going to do it in a slightly different way. I'm posing for you a quiz question right at the beginning that I'll get to at the end, which is, what is so remarkably, unbelievably strange about this tshuva, strange, surprising, whatever the right word would be, about this responsum? So today's responsum is Shut Mishpatei Uziel, Krach Aleph, the first volume, Orach Chaim Simon Yedal, the Orach Chaim section, responsum number 14. So Aleph Yudalit, Aleph Orachaim Yudalit, Shut Mishpatei Uziel. The first, it's two responses together. It's the second one, it's actually three responses together. The third one is from the 16th of Kislev, and we'll get to it. But the first one is labeled Shnat Hey Tov Reish Ayin Hey, which was basically 1914 to 15. So there, the question came up about kitniot. So kitniot is a custom. Let's remember, as we start the tshuva, Rav Ben Mitzir Meir Chai Uziel, who was an important Rav. He was born in 1880, passed away in 1953. He was eventually the first Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel. Before that, he was a Sephardic chief rabbi of, I forget where, and then of Israel even before the state, and then after the state started, he was the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel. So that is the information that you need to know for us to understand and talk about this tshuva. The question is the problem of kitniot. Kitniot is the custom that some people have, I should say that many, many people have, to refrain from eating certain things on Pesach, even though they are clearly not prohibited. An example would be, let's say Ashkenazim don't eat rice on Pesach. So they don't eat rice on Pesach for a reason we're about to talk about, and that falls in the category of kitniot, or corn is another example of kitniot. There are many others as well, but kitniot are these things that are somewhat chametz-like in a couple of ways. So the Uziel explains to us that the source of the custom is a Mordechai in Pesachim, and the Mordechai quotes a smak. The smak was a sefer mitzvot katan. It's a 13th century work. So we're talking about a custom that goes back to around the 1200s. By the time of the smak, the mid to late 1200s, by the time of the smak, he already knows of this custom. And he doesn't say this is the custom and this is why we did it. He says this is the custom we've seen, and he says it's a gzerah. Since you make kitniot, like rice and beans and things like that, you make them in a pot the same way you might make some kind of grain dishes, right? If you're not going to turn wheat or oats or barley, is one that we still do today very much, you're not going to turn barley into a flour and make a bread out of it. You might eat just barley in a soup, or barley, you don't cook barley. People eat it and enjoy it. So since they're all the kinds of things that are cooked in a pot, an example he gives is daisa, which in modern Hebrew is oatmeal, but is an oat dish of some sort. You might think, since I see you can make rice in a pot, some kind of a rice mash in a pot, maybe you can make some kind of an oat mash in a pot. Right? You know that you can't have chametz, but you might think you can make it in a pot, and then what's going to happen is if you make a mash out of it, you're going to get water on it, and it can be mit chametz, and that's a big problem. So that was one of the sources that's given for the custom, is the worry that if you have kitniot, you'll come to think that you're allowed to do certain things with actual grains that you're not allowed to do on Pesach. Also, in some places, he says, people make breads out of these things. You can make a cornbread. It's a little hard if you're not going to use any wheat flour, but you can make a cornbread. You can make a rice bread. You can make a potato bread. Or you can make all this. The potato is not actually kitniot, but it's a question, not our responsive question. There's a question as to why it's not kitniot, but the idea being the kitniot, the kinds of that you can make into a bread. And again, you'll confuse them with the five grains. You'll think that these kinds of breads are okay. I mean, let's say I made a Mizonos roll out of a rice bread. Somebody might say to themselves, oh, if it's only a Mizonos roll, it's not chametz, and you're allowed to use it on Pesach. Therefore, because of the worry that people will not understand the halachot well enough, and they'll make a false equivalence, they will equate two things that really aren't equatable. So because of that, the custom became, the Smak quotes it as a gezeira, which would be an important factor, as a decree, that you don't use it on Pesach. And he says it's a good custom to avoid all kidney and legumes as well, and even to put it into boiling water. So the reason why boiling water is you might think the boiling water would stop it from being mitchames, from leavening, because you'll scald it, and that will maybe short-circuit any kind of a leavening process. That's what the Mordechai quotes as the Smak's reasoning for the prohibition for not having kidney on Pesach. In the tour in Kufnun Gimel, he adds another reason, that there are those who say that also sometimes, a lot of times, you'll have pieces of grain will mix in, meaning in a world where it was hard to keep things so separate from each other, the fact that I have a rice sack in one place and a wheat or an oat or a barley sack in another place, that's not going to be as carefully kept, and therefore my rice sack might have some wheat in it and I won't even notice it. So if I allow myself to make grains, to make kidney oat, which are also grains, but different kinds of, let's say, quinoa, right? If I last myself quinoa, I might end up having a lot of oats or enough oats, or on Pesach itself, we think there's oats or mushroom, but I would have oats or wheat or whatever in it, and that would be another problem. So those are the two reasons that are given for the custom to refrain from using or eating kidney on Pesach. One reason being that it looks so much like chametz in a lot of ways that people end up thinking they're allowed to do with actual grains what we allow ourselves to do with legumes. So therefore, the decision was made not to have legumes and kidney oat and those kinds of quasi grains at all. And then the second reason being that they often mixed with each other, and since they often mixed with each other, that would be another problem. The first way of saying it, though, turns it into a siag. So a siag is a rule that's made to protect from something going wrong. It's not that the action itself is wrong, it's that you don't want, that you're worried that this will lead to that. That's called a siag, like a fence, a border, a boundary, to make sure that we don't go to the next step of the actual wrong thing. If that's true, though, it enters into this complicated sugya that Rav Uziel deals with. I have excerpted these tshuvot very greatly, meaning I cut them down to size so we can talk about them in a reasonable period of time. But Rav Uziel points out that raises a whole topic in halacha as to whether or not such rules, such laws, are revocable at all. The Rambam, for example, seems to believe that if a court makes an ordinance, and the point of the ordinance is to try to protect against problematic possible outcome, possible consequences, and they made it intending it to last forever, they just made it a blanket rule, then it was accepted by the Jewish people, then no later court, even if the standard often is what's called Beit Din Gadol b'chachmo v'minyan, if a later court was wiser, which is a standard to think about, or had more numbers. And more numbers also tend to think about on our topic today, so I'm not going to get into it, so we'll just use those terms. But those are terms you'd have to figure out if you were going to try to actually justify a later court uprooting what an earlier court had done. In this kind of situation, there are plenty of other situations. The Rambam says later courts are allowed to revoke or uproot what an earlier court has done. Sometimes you need them to be smarter and wiser and larger. Sometimes you don't. That's another important, interesting sugya, but not the topic centrally of our discussion. The Rambam holds, though, that in these kinds of ordinances that are made to protect, so then even if a later court has the qualifications, they're not allowed to change it. Okay? And if they didn't make it forever, they just made it, they didn't say when it was going to be for, so then you'd need a larger court, a court that's larger and wiser. Gadol b'chokhma uv'minyan. And if they made a specific condition, so then even a smaller court can do it as well. That's the Rambam's view. There are other views, however, that Rav Uziel points out. Tosfos hold that there's, in the Gemara, you have what's called eight, there's a Yud-Chet Dvarim that was in the Sugya in Shabbat, where there's 18 things that were ordained on a certain specific day. So in those 18 things, which if they spread among the Jewish people, so the Jewish people started keeping them, so then Tosfos still held, even though they spread and they were made as part of a special group of takanot, of ordinances, a later court, if it's larger, greater, in chachma v'minyan, in wisdom in number, they could revoke it. And if the gezeira didn't spread, that's the whole topic goes on as well, what's considered spreading or not, then even a smaller court could change it. And the Ran, the third opinion that was Yael quotes is, the Ran says that if the gezeira was spread and was observed and was kept, then no court can change it, even if they're larger, gadol b'chokh v'minyan, in number and wisdom. But if it didn't spread, but it is the kind of thing that you could imagine that the courts today, when they think about it, can imagine that people would be able to live up to, then he holds that you would need, you could uproot it, but you would need a Beit Din that's larger, gadol b'chokhma v'minyan, and if it didn't spread, and you come to realize that people couldn't stand by this gzeira today, that you just couldn't, they couldn't bear up to it, so then you could have it even a smaller court. So the point being that there's a there's a large, a wide range of opinions about the ability of later courts to uproot something that came beforehand. So if we see this Kitniot issue as a gezeira, as a decree, a protected decree that was made to protect the Torah and to make sure that people don't do the wrong thing, so then you'd have to decide which of these opinions you follow on whether and when a later court can change that thing, and then you'd have to look around. So if you said it could be any court, you would need to look around so much. But if you need a larger court, a Chacham Min, you'd have to start looking around for it. So in our case, it would seem to mean the Rambam would say there's no way to get out of Kitniot, out of the Kitniot issue, because it's a gezeira, it was a protective measure, and it was made it was made to last forever, and it seems to have spread among these people, because you look around and many, many people are keeping the custom of Kitniot, and therefore you can't change it at all. So that would be a problem. However, says Rosiel, he thinks there is a way to see some kind of a heter, even according to the Rambam, that it might be that when we say that a later court cannot uproot it, all what we mean is they can't uproot it completely. And this is a tense topic, because it leaves room for lots of abuse of the situation. Because what Ravuziel says is, maybe, however, when a new condition arose, and that new condition makes it in the moment very difficult to observe that gezerah, then maybe for some specific period of time, a later court would be allowed to approve it, to uproot it, and to say you don't have to follow that gzeirah, because we would say to ourselves that we might implicitly be able to understand that when the earlier court made their takana, they would have understood this, and they would have understood that if this situation arises, you can temporarily, meaning that we're not able to fully uproot it, we're not able to just wipe it away, but we would be able to say that in this particular year, they didn't mean for it to happen. Now, he says that, and I think it makes sense to say that, because for example, there are times when we allow Nevi'im, that they're prophets, so they have the word of Hashem, but to uproot the Torah. But I think there's room, there are people who say that there are times when we might trust there as a Tosfos, I think, that says that we might even allow a Beit Din, a court, to do that as well. That to say that we're not taking away from the Torah, we're just saying that right now we want to do it. An example would be, when we, at least B'sheva Al-Taseh, whereby refraining from action, we don't blow shofar whenever Rosh Hashanah is on a Shabbat. So that's an example of, we say that there's a particular need here, and therefore they, so he says that would be a possibility. Now, if that were true, if we're going to allow ourselves to think that the fact that we can be pretty sure that they would have agreed to this loophole, to this exception for this period of time, then you might also be able to claim that if we came across a situation where we are fairly certain that they would have agreed that we should no longer keep to this, right, whatever that situation would be, we should no longer keep to this, meaning let's suppose, I'm just making something up now, but let's suppose a time came when nobody eats the five grains anymore, really, other than for mitzvot purposes, but they all eat kitniot, and kitniot are completely separate from these other things. You can imagine somebody saying, theoretically, well, they never meant to tell us that we couldn't eat anything on Yom Tov that we're at all used to, and we have to switch. Anyway, possibility. He says, so it's just a possibility. But then he says, I haven't found any poskim who say it, and therefore I wouldn't rely on my own idea that we could rely on this. Meaning his idea started off with, he would think that a temporary uprooting should be okay, because that's true in other situations than halacha. We can assume that the original court would have allowed for that. But once you're going to say we can assume the original court, then you would say, well, I can assume the original court might have said, no, we should stop it at this point as well, which we don't say. And he doesn't have any poskim to say, so he moves on to a different way of thinking about it. He says, when I think about it again, the truth is I framed the whole question wrong. And I discussed it this way because he's Ravuziel. So if he realizes he framed the question wrong, it's important for us to realize that sometimes we framed the question wrong, we have to be careful about it. Because in fact, the tradition isn't that somebody made a gezeirah, that a court made an ordinance to protect against certain things. If you look at the Mordechai, and the language Mordechai uses is, it's a minhag, it's a custom that arose. Now, it's a custom that arose, And the Mordechai, by the time the Mordechai and the Smak, they're already willing to say it's a good custom, but it's not a top-down created custom. It's a popular custom that then became accepted. Now, why that's important is because then we get into the topic that, which as it happens, I taped a shiur on this 2 days ago, on a shiur that touched on the topic 2 days ago. We discussed, I'm sorry, I did it 2 days ago. You'll have heard it a week ago, because I'm pretty sure it was the 9th of Kislev, but I'm just closing up gaps in my shiurim now. So if it was, for me, it was 2 days ago. For you, it was probably a week ago, where if Cook was asked about the kashrut standards in Tzfat in terms of checking the brains of slaughtered animals, whether or not you have to check them, you had a custom or not. So you discussed the issue that we're talking about right now. So you might think that I'm just coming back to these same topics over and over again, but I want to be clear that I picked these tshuvot far distant from each other. So I don't remember which tshuva that I picked when I picked them. I have long forgotten other tshuvot by the time I picked these. And this one I picked early on in the process because I picked it for my father-in-law's yahrzeit on a Shabbos that I wanted to give a shir in honor of his memory. But it comes to this topic because once you have a custom, then it's even more of an issue as to whether or not you can change a custom. Until now, we're talking about changing a gezerah, and there were all sorts of rules about whether we could change an ordinance that was made by a court. But now we have what's called a minhag avot, the custom of one's forefathers, and that touches on a central sugya in Psachim Nun Amud Bet, and the Rav Uziel says it much similar to the way we saw Rav Kook say it, because that's the way people understand it, which was the B'nai Baishan, the people of Baishan, or the sons of Baishan, they had a custom not to travel from Tzor to Tzidon, from Tyre to Sidon on Fridays, and then their descendants, either their children or their descendants, came to Rav Yochanan and said they were able to and we're not able to, and he said, too bad, it's a minhag avot. So that, Rav Uziel points out that it's codified in Shulchan Aruch, that when you have a minhag avot, when you have a custom of one's forefathers, and it's because of a siyag, so that's like a kabbalat harabim. It's an acceptance of the masses of people. And when you have an acceptance of the masses to do X or Y or Z, it applies not only to them, but to their descendants. And even if they did it on their own without a formal promulgation of an edict, without a formal process of declaring it a law, nonetheless, that same rules applies. And you can't get rid of it. And the assumption seems to be in Shulchan Aruch that you also can't be matir and neder on it. You can't remove it. Now, I try hard, although I fail regularly, not to insert myself into the proceedings. But once again, I have to say that the idea that you can't do hatar and nedarim here makes a custom even more serious and more stringent than an actual neder in the Torah. And I find that difficult and problematic. But this is not my venue. This is Rav Uziel's venue today, so we're going to just follow what he has to say. So he says, you have the B'nai Baishan, and that story shows that when you have a custom of your forefathers, you just have to follow it. And the Rav Yochanan case seems to show that even if situations change, so that it's difficult and problematic. Now, as I said a week ago, in what you've heard, the question of levels of change seems to be relevant as a topic here. But in any case, it says that even if the situation changed with Rav Yochanan, because they're saying to him that they can't stand it anymore, nonetheless, you have to stick to the minhag. So, and when they did change stuff, sometimes they change stuff just for poor people. So Rav Uziel says, I don't see any room in our situation to be matirit. And I think that if I said the poor people can do X and the rich people can do Y, in our times, it's not going to do anything because everybody will say, oh, I'm poor. And then they will just insist that they can do it. And then he adds, and also, by the way, I'm not going to say that you can have kitniot because it seems to me this year, the kitniot that we have, there aren't so many so common kidney. It's not like kidney is going to help us. You have afunin v'adashim, which I think is peas and lentils. And the reason why that's important is because he says those aren't the kinds of foods you eat as like a meal, as like something that'll fill you up. What you do with it is you eat them with bread and they sort of fill you up along with the bread. But he says once we're doing that, allowing it won't help us at all because we have a lot of vegetables. We have plenty of vegetables around. They're cheap. And so if all we're looking for is things to supplement the bread meal, then we can do without the kidney. And therefore, he says, I see no reason to allow kidney out, and therefore I can't give, and we have a custom of our forefathers not to have kidney out, and that's all we can do. So that was the tshuva from Tuf Reish Ayin Hay from 1915. The next tshuva we're going to do is the next tshuva in the book. So Zeman Ted Rav, and he is quoting here the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel at the time, Rav Chaim Moshe Eliashar. And so this is 1915. He's a young man. He's a 35-year-old man. Rav Uziel and Rav Eliashar is a much senior Torah scholar. And he refers to Rav Uziel's letter from the 3rd of Nisan. So it could be that that first tshuva that we saw was from the 3rd of Nisan. And he says, and I saw your letter, what you said, that you think it's prohibited. And then you asked me for my opinion, which would later happen to Rav Uziel. Many times we've seen that people would send him stuff and ask for his opinion. He's now, as a young man, he did it to Rav Eliashar as well. So Rav Eliashar says, I only took a tiny little bit because my interest is not Rav Eliashar himself. It's just this whole topic. And starting with the tshuva of Rav Uziel, we're going to get the next one in the book, number 16 in the book. That's going to be the one from the 16th of Kislev. So he says, Rav Eliashar says, you said in your tshuva, as I think many people have said, you said in your tshuva that when once something is a custom, that custom doesn't bind them as a neder, as a vow, which would be open to the possibility of nullification or of a chacham realizing that conditions have changed and therefore we can change it, but because of a pasuk of Al titosh torat imecha, that you're not supposed to stray from the paths of your mother, meaning your nation, and there's no hatara there. So Rav Eliashar says, you'll forgive me, but I think that's a big machloket, and I think that it's not clear at all that that's the halakha. And so let me just tell you a couple of points because I don't have time to write it fully. But he says the Rosh wrote that a chacham can be matir anet, can be matir a minog, a custom becharata, if we can show that we regret. And I think really Ashar is implying, if we can show that it's likely that the original people would regret making that and instituting the custom as blanketly as they did, that we can make a hatara just as much as we could have made a hatara with an actual net or with an actual vow. The Rashba, however, seems to say that there's no hetar la'olam, you can't change it forever, you just stuck with it forever. And the Beis Yosef, says Rabbi Ashar, he seems to have followed more of the rush. So that would mean that there is room, according to the Beit Yosef, to change such customs or to uproot them or to say that they didn't apply to this situation because the person who made it, had he known this situation would arise, or the people who made it, our forefathers who made it, they would never have done it. Maharaj Dam, in his Chuvot, the Chelek Yeradeh, he disagreed. And he said, more according to the way that Rav Uziel said it, that a custom of the forefathers, there's no way to do hatara, there's no way to uproot it, to get rid of it, even by charata. And then Maharaj Dam says, and I wrote it this way because the Marik sounds like the opposite, and I don't know where you got it from. So the point is, Rav Elisha says, that's a complicated topic of halakha. And I've been saying, I said it when I taped the shiur of Kook, and now when I taped this shiur, that I thought that this was the majority of poskim. So because of the ones I've seen, I've already said it as if it's an obvious thing that that's the way to read that sig of B'nai Baishan. But now we realize that, if I'd only done a little bit more research, we have a rush, we have a Beis Yosef, according to Rav Ashar, I haven't checked him up on his sources, but we have a rush, we have a Beis Yosef, we have a Maharik, who all seems to think that no, that even with customs, and it, to me it makes so much sense, because it would be hard to imagine the customs are more stringent than actual vows, which are actually Surei Torah in a formal technical sense. However, that's all just a side point that he makes. But in terms of halacha, he says, I think you're right, that since you don't make any breads out of the kinds of kitna we have available today, you can't make it into any kind of a dough like you could with, he says, rice or potatoes. Now, potatoes to me is interesting because he's throwing it in. I think he means to say that he thinks potatoes also count as kitniyot. In the communities in which I've grown up, we don't count potatoes and kidney oat. And I think Rav Moshe Feinstein said, I once saw a tshuva of his where he says that potatoes aren't kidney oat because our forefathers, when they first encountered potatoes were a fairly late crop in human history. When they first encountered potatoes, they did not treat it with the halakha of kidney oat. And to include something in kidney oat requires a new thing. That's what I think Rav Moshe said. Now, if that were true, I would want to question whether corn ever became kidney oat, because I don't think corn formally became kidney oat. I think people just assumed it was kidney oat. Anyways, not our topic. So that's what Rav Eliezer had said to Rav Uziel. Rav Uziel answered him briefly. And the reason why I thought it was interesting, he says, you know, most of the Sfarim that you quoted, I don't have. Now, I don't know which ones he means. And I didn't take all of Rav Eliezer's tshuva, but I think it's also a very good reminder that even our great Torah scholars very often labored under the handicap of not having access to the width, the breadth of a library that we would have liked, and yet they managed to become truly significant and truly important and truly worth relying upon Torah scholars. In any case, but he says, I see the Rishonim that I've seen is that you can't change it, but even though they change, you can only change it with a petach v'charata. You can only change it by finding a way to say they would regret it. But the Chatam Sofer, he says, that I've seen, says Rav Uziel, says to do that, you'd need to, if you're going to do it for a previous generation, you need to have the majority of the Torah scholars of that place to get together, which is impossible at our times in 1915, says Rav Uziel. That's another one of these like throwaway comments that I find fascinating, because Rav Uziel's in 1915, I'm pretty sure there aren't 100,000 Jews in Israel yet. And so how many of them are Torah scholars, and what's the majority of those Torah scholars? And yet, it was seen as impossible to get together a conference. Now, later in his life, Rav Uziel many times, and I've seen, I don't know many of his tshuvot, and I've seen more than a few times that he very much wanted to get together a conference of Torah scholars to make all sorts of important halakhic decisions that depend on that kind of a thing, and it never came to fruition. But here, what you see early in his life, that he's beginning to point out that it would be great if we could get all the Torah scholars together to discuss the topic and to vote on it and to get and come to conclusions on it, and it didn't happen. So all of that is preparation, although we don't have so much time left for the final tshuva, which is a significant one as well, which is number 16 in the book. So there's Krach Aleph Orachayim Siman Ted Zion, and this one is dated the 16th of Kislev of Hey Tufresh Ayin Zion. This is late 1916, when they're already starting to think about Pesach of 1917. So he's talking to the Rabbanim of Yafo, who tell him about how in the 1916 and 17 is World War One. There's a war going on. Rav Kook has been stuck outside of Eretz Yisrael. He got stuck in England during the war. The financial, economic condition in Eretz Yisrael is very terrible. And they turned to Rav Uziel and said, we don't have to tell you how hard it is financially. And not only do we have a lot of poor people, but now there are people until now have been solidly middle class, and they're becoming poor because there's just no way to make, there's no money and there's no food. And the number of people who are living in hunger grows day to day. I recently started the autobiography of Rav Goren. And Rav Goren talks about how when they moved to Eretz Yisrael, which is right around this time, I don't remember exactly, I think it's a little later, I think it's the 1920s, when his family moved to Eretz Yisrael, however it happened, they got into a situation where they were hungry almost every day. And his father brought a lot of money, and he lost it on a land deal. And it's just a terrible story. It reminds us of the dedication and the commitment and the sacrifice that the early settlers of Eretz Yisrael did, both those who are Shomrei Torah Mitzvot. So there, it's impressive, but at least I understand why they're doing it. But even, maybe in some sense, even more impressive, those who didn't have the Torah connection to Eretz Yisrael and yet were stubborn about building it up. So the rabbis of Tzfat turned to Rav Uziel, we've got this problem, and we have a vod, we have a committee that makes sure to get matzah for everybody. And they've come to realize that there's no way that they can get enough matzah for all the poor people for Pesach if they're going to use wheat flour. Question is, can you include a little bit of kidney yod, if you can use a little bit of lentils or of beans in the flour, so then, or to give that out to people, and that could help out in the situation. So they want to head there for kidney yod. So he writes back, and he says, it's such an important thing, I'm writing you back right away. He says, and I think it's clear to everybody, the dura, which is something called durum wheat. But it's not an actual wheat. I mean, it's a wheat, but it's not a wheat like what we call wheat. And therefore, everybody agrees that that's kidney oat. From durum wheat, you can make breads and things like that. So he says, it's not a matzah that you can be yotzei your mitzvah with. But if you can make a matzah out of durum, which you would do the same way as regular matzah, you would take the durum and grind it into a flour, and then as soon as you put the water on the flour, you wouldn't let it rise. You would make matzah out of it. You can make that for all the rest of Pesach. He thinks that there's room to say that you can do that, because when we have a takana, when we prohibited kidney oat, and it's a chumrah, he says, that is spread among all of the diaspora, and here's where I'm going to answer our quiz question, which is what is so strange about this tshuva, is that we've spent this whole time talking about kidney oat, and the one talking about is Rav Uziel, who is a clear Sephardi, eventually the Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel, and he's talking with Rav Chaim Moshe Eliashar, who is the Sephardi chief rabbi of Israel. He's Rishon Lezion of Eretz Israel, and they're talking about the prohibition of kidney oat as if it applies to them as much as to any other Jew. Whereas when I was growing up, it was clear that Ashkenazim kept the prohibitions of kidney oat and Pesach, and Sephardim did not, because that wasn't their custom. So I later found out that it's not quite true. There are many Sephardim who don't keep the kidney oat, but there are many Sephardim who do, and these Sephardim clearly did. So the question is, what can you do about it? And therefore he says, because it's such a dire situation, here's what I think you can do. Since the worry was, the two worries of kidney oat were that you would meant there would be wheat mixed in and you wouldn't realize it, or B, that you would cook it in a pot and people would confuse it with real grains and think that it's allowed to make real grains. He says, all you're doing is making matzah out of it. First of all, you'll be careful. The worry that there's wheat mixed in doesn't bother you because you're making it out of the same, with the same care as if it's grain. So he says, if you're doing that, and he talks about, I have to rush a little bit because I'm running out of time, but if you're talking about something that's being done not by random individuals, but it's only being done, you know, under a hechsher, as it were, under supervision, and by a communal vod, a communal committee, so they're going to know how to take the proper care with it. So if they're going to make it as if it was matzah, even if you had some real wheat mixed in, you wouldn't have to care about it because you couldn't use it for the mitzvah of matzah and pesach, but you're making it with all the care, so there's no way it could become chametz anyway, so that's not a problem. He says he thinks another avenue to head there to permissibility is that the custom of kidney oat as it arose applied to individuals. It never dealt with the situation of if you have a communal body, which is under the supervision of rabbis, that's going to take the lead in preparing kidney oats for people to use. There is no such thing. Now, you can say, well, there's no such thing because they never thought about it. That's fine. But, says Rav Uziel, in all such situations, we only have what the takana was, what the rule was. Remember, he's being very machmir on the fact that once the rule is made, you can't change it, even though new conditions arose. So now he's saying, but that same idea that I don't do things because new conditions arose, I also don't add chumras because new conditions arose. The custom is the custom. The ordinance is the ordinance. I don't add to it just because I think it probably comes under the rubric of what they meant. Now, this comes up because I actually have heard of a Rav. I won't say it by name because I'm about to disagree with him. But I heard of a Rav in Eretz Yisrael who says, I think that kitniot should be anything that once you produce it looks a lot like bread. You shouldn't eat it on Pesach. Right? So let's say these potato dishes. There's all sorts of wonderful, tasty things one can have on Pesach today that are made with potatoes. Potatoes, let's assume, is not kitniot because the Rav Moshe finds that it's not kitniot. So this Rav would say, but I wouldn't eat it because it looks too much like bread. It tastes too much like bread. I think you're not supposed to be having bread on Pesach. So I think that Rav Uziel is clearly disagreeing with that perspective. And he's saying, no, the custom of kitniot was whatever it was. And in the same way, we're not allowing ourselves to uproot it for any reason, because it's a custom from our forefathers, we don't need to add to it either. And then he points out that he gave a different tshuva 2 years earlier, a different response a year and a half earlier, but for the Pesach of Tavrei Shayin Hay of 1915, he'd given a different response, but he says, now that situation has changed, and the needs are much greater, and therefore you'll even need to be able to eat beans and things. He says he thinks that you can rely upon all those who say B'Shadat Chanak, in a time of stress you can be mati these things, and therefore he says, but I think that even when you're going to eat peas and beans or whatever you're going to eat, you have to buy them not from the general marketplace. That he thinks would still fall into the kidney or problem, but let the local community establish a hashgacha, right? And they would say, these kidney out are kosher Pesach. And they'll have checked them out carefully, and they'll have said there's no other meat and stuff mixed in. So under the pressure of the financial stress of 1916 to 17 and World War I, Rav Uziel gives us this second tshuva of his, the second response of his about kidney out, in which he's willing to allow, A, the baking of matzot from kidney out grains and kinds of things, and that's okay because it gets around the prohibition, and in Shadat Chak, that's okay. And the fact that it's being done by a communal body means it's not really fully part of the original Gzeira of kidney out. You don't add to a Gzeira. And then also, he'll even allow having some beans and peas because those are very necessary for people just for their diet. But those two he would require to be under the hashkach of the local community and not to be bought personally. So a surprising set of tshuva from Rav Uziel about kidney on Pesach. Most surprising because these are Sephardim who are clearly very concerned about the prohibitions and intend to keep to them, except with the exception of whatever it is that Rav Uziel was able to allow them to do, as he did in the Pesach of 1917. With thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hachazer for putting these shiurim online, make them available to you. I bid you a good day.